Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Big story this morning. Breaking news. This just in. Ezekiel Elliott has a contract. Absolutely incredible. Unreal. Unprecedented. How the hell is that even possible? How did they get that deal done? I thought that the new deals for Jalen Smith, DeMarcus Lawrence, and Lyle Collins meant that there was not enough money to go around. Was it not just yesterday that Jerry Jones was telling a local radio station that there was not enough dough to go around?
There's no question the pie is getting smaller to the extent that we look at how much we're allocating to each and every player, each and every position. It creates boundaries.
He just said this. Yet hours later, we have a deal for Ezekiel Elliott. It's absolutely amazing. You know what? It's a miracle. Just when you thought that this could not happen, just when you thought the Dallas Cowboys had run out of money, they find enough to pay their Pro Bowl running back. Jarrah must have really dug through the couches and the ashtray on that party bus to find every penny he could to make that happen. Yeah, either that, or it was always going to happen, and the last few weeks have been a very boring, very predictable, very fake, very manufactured drama with an attempt at some sort of dramatic, explosive ending. I mean, weren't Elliott and his agent deeply wounded and offended by Jerry's Zeke who joke? Wasn't that unbelievable level of disrespect supposed to derail everything? I thought that hilarious zinger was going to wreck any chance they had of getting this deal done. Maybe even obliterate that bridge and that relationship altogether, right? Yet somehow, amazingly, it didn't. Somehow these two sides, the billionaire and the Pro Bowl running back, managed to put all of that aside and come to an agreement. And even more incredibly, they got the agreement done just in time for Elliott to be on track to play in week one. Again, absolutely incredible. I mean, damn, Jarrah really is a hero. Like, Jarrah knew the fans wanted Elliott on the field in week one, and damn if he wasn't going to get it done and give his beloved fans exactly what they wanted. This old man is a legend. Oh, side note on Jarrah. Do you know where Jarrah was this morning? While you were freaking out about him reportedly agreeing to a $90 million deal with a running back, he was at the New York Stock Exchange ringing the bell to celebrate a $2.2 billion acquisition of an energy company. Yeah, I don't think this old guy is in any danger of running out of money anytime soon. Hell, that money he just guaranteed for Elliott is walk-around money for that old dude. I mean, please. Is there anybody anywhere who actually believed that this was not going to happen? Did anybody really buy the idea that the Cowboys were not going to sign Elliott? Did anybody really think that the deals for Smith, Collins, and Lawrence meant that Elliott was not going to get his? Of course not. Hell no. We all knew it. And most of all, Elliott knew it. He knew he was going to get his. Whatever his turns out to be. Because, as always, the devil of the deal is in the deets. And the initially reported amount of the contract is rarely the actual amount of the contract, so we don't know exactly what this deal is. Only that we knew he was going to get it. Why? Because even though the running back position continues to be devalued by teams, Elliott had the hammer, not Jarrah. He had the hammer because the offense runs through him, not Dak Prescott. They go as Elliott goes. Dak goes as Elliott goes. Elliott's more important to that offense than Dak. Dak needs Elliott more than Elliott needs Dak. Hell, the Cowboys need Elliott more than he needs them. Obviously, this is why he got over. That's why he got them to extend him while he still had multiple years left on a rookie deal when teams are devaluing the running back position. Perfect execution by Elliott. He gets to miss all of camp, all of the preseason, while hanging out and doing work in Cabo, gets his pile of dough, and then he can waltz right in before the opener. textbook. He got over. Like, take Melvin Gordon. He tried the same thing with the Chargers, but it didn't work. Primarily because he's not as great. I mean, he is great, but not as great as Elliott. Not as important to the Chargers as Elliott is to the Cowboys. What I'm saying is, Elliott is their best player. Everyone knows that. Defenses are way more concerned about stopping him than they are Prescott. So it was going to happen. This was going to happen. We knew this. So why the whole routine? Why the whole charade? For the same reason that Jerry Jones does anything. Attention. To get people to look at him. To get people to talk about him. The Dallas Cowboys have been talked about every single day for the last however many weeks. And who has been at the center of the whole thing? Jera. Every single day, there was something new. Hands being severed in car accidents.
The hand was almost severed off.
Zeke who?
Zeke who?
Eyes being split up.
Eyes getting smaller.
Hands being severed.
Your hand was almost severed off.
Zeke who?
Zeke who?
Pies being severed.
Eyes getting smaller.
Hands being severed.
Your hand was almost severed off.
Zeke who?
Zeke
who? Right? See, the thing that Jerry likes more than winning? If there's something Jerry likes more than winning, and there is, it's being talked about, being looked at. You see, being talked about is a win for him. In fact, being talked about is his Super Bowl, especially since he hasn't been able to get anywhere near the actual Super Bowl in years. So I don't know if Ezekiel Elliott got all the money he wanted, but Jerry Jones got exactly what he wanted. Us to look at him and talk about him. And he's going to run it all back when he gets around to doing Dak's deal. And then there'll be more talk about hands being severed.
What do you mean?
Pies being severed.
Zeke who?
Dak who? Amari who?
Eyes getting smaller.
Jimmy Johnson who?
Your hand was almost severed off.
How about them Cowboys? Yeah!
Terrell Davis is my guest. TD, what's up? Good morning. How are you?
Jim, how you doing this morning?
Good,
doing
good.
Well.
How about you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. You know, just heard the news, obviously, with Zeke getting paid. So as a former running back, I think that is a great, great sign for the future of running backs. And the position can no longer be said to be devalued.
All right, I'm glad you brought that up. So knowing what he means to the Cowboys, how important was it, in your opinion, for them to get that deal done and get him on the field to start the season?
Yeah, I thought it was very important. You know that offense is really designed to run through Zeke. And, you know, Jerry Jones made the comment early in the year that he didn't want to set the market for, you know, that position, and he didn't feel like that he had to. But when a guy is valuable to your team, it doesn't really matter what position he plays. But Zeke is really responsible for the Cowboys being where they are. I know they have a good defense. I know they have, you know, Amari Cooper now, and Dak has been playing well. But it runs through Zeke, and to have him back in the building before week one, I think for them is a really good sign for their future, really.
We're talking to Terrell Davis. You know, back to your point about devaluing the position, overall, do you feel like great running backs get the respect that they deserve around the league from front offices and get paid what they deserve? Or do you feel like they do undervalue the great running backs and they think they could just find somebody off to redo the job?
Sort of the draft. If you can get a running back, first-round draft pick, you'll have a guy who's 21, 20 years old. You really got him in his prime, and then you'll run him till he's 24, let's say 25 years old, and then if he's already had a successful career like Zeke had, your thought is, well, he's had, you know, his better days are probably behind him, so why are we going to pay for these future years where we may not get that production? And so I think that's kind of the problem, that you can have a back, you're not paying him any money the first couple of years, and so maybe the CBA may have to change in terms of letting guys be free agents earlier, and I know this may not even happen, but have some special clause for the running back position, which allows them to be able to hit free agency at an earlier stage. Now, I know that's not going to happen, but that's kind of the only way you're going to be able to solve this, because the attitudes are going to stay the same if you allow the CBA to operate the way it's operating, you know.
No, I think you're right. I think sign up to become an O Rewards member today and earn 1 point for every $1 you spend. Receive your rewards twice as fast and on the go when you provide your email address. O Rewards members get $5 back for every $150 they spend. It is fast, it's easy, it's free, only at O'Reilly Auto Parts. See store or orewards.com for details. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. For instance, I mean, should running backs, the way you lay that out, should running backs have shorter contracts when they first come in so they can get to that second contract faster?
Yeah. I mean, a quarterback's got time. You know, a QB can sign a 5-year deal, and then, you know, when he signs that second deal, they're looking at him like, oh, he is just hitting his prime. A wide receiver, the same thing. You know, a rush in, a left tackle, everybody else seems to have time. But when you look at the running back, it's always this case for, hey, man, you know, he might not have the same production once we pay him. And so, again, I don't know how you solve it, but it certainly needs to be looked at by the Players Association. And if they can do something about it, hopefully they will.
Terrell Davis joining us on the program. So after Andrew Luck announced his retirement a few weeks back, you said, quote, I understood 100%. So what kind of thoughts and emotions did you have when you heard him talk about the physical and mental pain of the game?
So from 1999, when I tore my ACL, in the fifth game of the year, from that time forward, I fought injuries until I retired in 2002. And what I mean is that I missed a lot of games. I was constantly in a training room. I was rehabbing injuries. And then once I was, you know, I thought I was healthy and I tried to bounce back, I'll have another injury. So it was like a 3-year span where I am dealing with injuries. I'm constantly just trying to get back to normal. And it took us toll. About that third, I remember, you know, retiring almost the same time as Andrew Luck, the last game of the preseason before the 2002 season. I had had enough. I mean, I had conceded because I knew that mentally I couldn't deal with it anymore. It had broken me down for over 3 years of trying to fight back. And that's where Andrew Luck is. You know, he fought the fight, and at some point he didn't quit. He conceded because he doesn't know if he's ever going to be healthy, fully healthy. And it's a difference between kind of playing with like little nicks where that's painful there. But when you have a physical thing where it prevents you from performing at the level that you're used to performing at, it is super difficult. And then, like you said, it just every man has his breaking point, and over time it just wears at you mentally. So when I walked away, it wasn't because I wanted to. I couldn't fight the fight anymore, and I felt the same way for Andrew Luck.
Terrell Davis joining us. I think that's really, really interesting what you just said, that he did not quit. He conceded. I mean, TD, for people like none of us have any idea what people like you or him or any player in the NFL ever goes through. So it might be part of the deal. Social media is social media. But when you hear folks accuse him of, quote, quitting, how does that make you feel? What do you think about that?
That pissed me off when people say he quit. He didn't quit. I mean, like I said, quitting is when you're able. If you're able and you're, you know, you physically you're good and you just quit because you don't feel like doing it, that's different. He didn't quit. He felt like he tried. And at some point, we all have our breaking point. And, you know, again, if you put somebody in an atmosphere where every morning you're the first one at the facility at 5 o'clock in the morning, you're then going through a routine of rehabbing, then you try to, you know, go to the meetings, and you do everything else the team is doing. When they go home, you go to more rehab. And you do that for 3 years straight. And then when you get to the field, you feel like a lot of things aren't right. You know, your knees are swelling up. You got constant pain. You're having constant setbacks. So that wears at you. So, yeah, when people say he quit, those are just, you know, a lot of people obviously have never experienced what he's gone through. And before you judge somebody who is going through it, take time to understand why he chose to retire. Don't criticize him until you find out why he's really walking away from the game. It's not because he wanted to, because he had to at that point.
Hall of Famer Terrell Davis joining us. Now, you were recently at the NFL 100 event with Saquon Barkley, among others. As one running back looking at another, what do you think when you see Barkley play and watch him go about his business?
Yeah, he's gifted. He's got a lot of natural tools. You know, he's the kind of back that if you were to build one, he kind of fits that mold. You know, you want a guy that's got, you know, he's strong. He's got great vision. He's got instincts. He's got athleticism. You know, he's intelligent. He's got a great personality. So he's got a lot of things you just watch him. And the one thing that I took away from him when I first met him last year and we talked is that I don't think he knows he's good, but he also has a little bit of I'm not sure. And so it makes him want to work harder to kind of prove to himself that he has a little bit of doubt. And I think that is great for somebody who feels like that because he knows that he can never kind of rest on his laurels. And I don't really like that about him. So I think he's always going to feel like he's got to prove something to somebody, and that keeps that fire going.
Before the breaking news of Ezekiel Elliott's amazing, shocking contract that absolutely nobody saw coming, the new contract spotlight actually belonged to Jared Goff. Now, here's what I find so fascinating about this. Because with extremely little fanfare, he agrees to a 4-year extension with the LA Rams last night, reportedly worth $134 million, reportedly worth an NFL record $110 million guaranteed. And this is why you want to be a quarterback and not a running back. Ezekiel Elliott gets a deal that has $50 million guaranteed, reportedly. Jared Goff is getting one that reportedly has more than double that guarantee. It's allegedly the most guaranteed money in NFL history. Reportedly. Possibly. Maybe. At least for the time being. You know, that title of most guaranteed money in league history is always weird because it's always changing hands. And every time it does, everybody freaks out that the person who gets it is not worthy of it. As always, the hard facts of the contract are probably different than what's being reported. But it just goes to show, running backs are nowhere near quarterbacks when it comes to value in that league. And that for all the hype and attention being paid to Ezekiel Elliott and his situation, Goff and the Rams reportedly did a deal worth double that. Let me reiterate what I said earlier. He gets double the guaranteed money with maybe 1% of the fanfare. Like, I didn't see Stan Kroenke out there talking about car accidents, severed hands, pie. Nor do I remember.
Getting smaller.
Kroenke saying, Jared who?
Zeke
who? Goff was not out there throwing to receivers in Cabo. And the world was not getting breathless Twitter updates from people who saw him on a commercial flight back to the States. There wasn't the hype or the fanfare about this deal, yet it's so much bigger than the Elliott deal. Twice the guaranteed money and a fraction of the fanfare. And just as every new contract for a running back means that we have to have some hot take debate about whether it's worth paying a running back big money, when it comes to quarterbacks, we have to debate whether they deserve the contract that they're getting. I mean, I've been really clear about this. I'm on record with this. You know my policy on this. If somebody is willing to pay you the money, you are worth the money. If the check does not rubberize, you are worth the money. If the check does not float, you are worth the money. And in the NFL, you're probably worth even more. And in the case of Jared Goff, he is worth it. Jared Goff, hey, you want a hot take? Here it is. Jared Goff is a franchise quarterback. Yeah, I said it. And if you've got a problem with that, that's on you. That's not on me. That's not on Goff. In the last 2 years, he's thrown for nearly 8,500 yards and 60 touchdowns. He's been named to a pair of Pro Bowls. He's gone 24-7 over that stretch. Quick. Name the other two quarterbacks in the NFL who've won that many games in the last two seasons. Go ahead. You need some more time? You're out of time. Tom Brady and Drew Brees. The list of quarterbacks with 24 wins in the last two seasons. Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Jared Goff. Are you still going to tell me he's not a franchise quarterback? Well, you want to give some credit to Sean McVay. Cool. Except McVay is not the one throwing the footballs. McVay is not the one taking the hits. I'm fine with giving some credit to McVay. I love the guy. But look who McVay is giving credit to. Goff. You never hear McVay say, it's all about the system. It's all about the coaching. You only hear McVay say, it's all about the guy. He's hyping his guy. And not just because he's his guy, but because McVay knows they're a great fit together. Quarterback and coach, quarterback and offense. You know, again, if you want to put all of this on McVay, fine. But this deal does not get done without McVay being all in favor of that deal. Like, if McVay thought that he could take somebody off the street and turn him into the same quarterback, a Pro Bowl quarterback, trust me, he would do that, and he would use that money elsewhere. He would. But the fact that he hasn't done that should tell you something. If you want to believe in McVay, you better believe in the guy that McVay believes in. And here's another aspect of Goff. He's not getting enough credit for. This dude's tough. Mentally tough, physically tough. The turnaround this guy made is absolutely incredible. Do you remember his rookie year? Do you remember when he started 7 games and lost all 7? Do you remember when this guy was being called a bust, an all-time bust? And that the trade to get him was a franchise ruiner. Do you remember that? I barely remember that. Because since then, he's won 2 straight divisional titles. He's taken his team to a Super Bowl. Remember Carson Wentz, the next big thing. The closest thing to a sure thing. You know, one of the previous benchmarks for quarterbacks. Goff has done more than Wentz. So most guys in that situation who experience what he experienced in that first year, they go into the tank, they never come out. All that losing, all those hits, all that heat, that gets to a young player. That ruins a young player. Not Goff. This guy came out the other end, and he did it in a hurry, and it was like it never even happened. And as always, paying a quarterback is not... I'm on record with this, too. I'm going to be very clear about this. Paying a quarterback is not about how good they are. It's about how good their timing is. Goff's is pretty damn good in that regard. You know who's even better? Dax. Because now Dak has another number to put in front of the Cowboys. You have to think that the only person happier than Goff about that deal is Dak, because you know that Dak's price just went up again. And then the only guy happier than both those guys is Patrick Mahomes, because he'll be due for an extension after this season, and his number is going to go through the roof. Better to get a deal done now before Mahomes resets the entire market. So let me ask you a question that I already know the answer to. Ever wonder where your family comes from? Of course, we all do. Now you can discover more about your family and learn more about your own story by combining the Ancestry DNA test with billions of historical family records. You see, Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started. It uses precise geographical detail and clear-cut historical insights. You can even trace your ancestors' journeys over time, following how and why your family moved from place to place. It's that detailed. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree so your ancestors become more than just a name. They do this by combining DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. And only Ancestry can tell such a rich, detailed story with unique features that give you a more complete picture about a person. You know, like events that shaped that person, how they made a living, and what they excelled in. And it is so easy to get started. Go to Ancestry.com/podcast right now and get 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Once again, Ancestry.com/podcast and get 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/podcast. We're joined by DeMarcus Ware. DeMarcus, it is great to have you back. How are you?
Hey, good, man. Listen, with that introduction, and especially that hype music, that's where we used to come out of the tunnel with the Dallas Cowboys, so I feel like it's game time. So what's up?
My man, what's up? It is so good to hear your voice. What was that like for those of us who will never, ever, ever experience it? What was it like to run out of that tunnel back in the day?
You know, the thing is, it's almost like you set the mood with the music that you just had on before the show. And then the thing is, you get all of your accolades, and you hear the heartbeat of the 12th man, the stadium just boom, boom, like yelling your name. And then as you walk through that tunnel, you start to see, like, all of the fans, you know, root for you. And then when you come out of it, it's almost like a big adrenaline rush as the uproar of the stadium as you go through the whole crowd. And it is crazy. it's like almost like you just get chills just going through it. I get chills right now just thinking about it.
Goosebumps, dude. I get the exact same feeling when I walk in this studio every single day. No, I don't.
That's what I'm talking about.
No, I don't. DeMarcus Ware joining us. Yes, I do. All right, so what was your reaction to the news that Ezekiel Elliott and the Cowboys got that contract extension done?
You know, it was actually two reactions. It was a sigh of relief for the team, knowing that how big Ezekiel Elliott is to the team, but also like a big, you know, smile, because the thing is, he just set a record for a lot of the running backs that, you know, now going behind him, it helps them get even bigger contracts. And the thing is, like, I feel like it's a good thing for the whole just NFL and the guys that are playing.
We're talking to DeMarcus Ware. So, DeMarcus, as a Dallas Cowboy, what was it like to negotiate a contract or a contract extension with Jerry Jones?
You know, the thing is, like, it's like a two-part process to where you go in first and your agent is negotiating everything and you go through all the fine-tuning. And then now Jerry Jones gives you an opportunity, is just you and him going to his office and talking to him about the whole contract. And he looks at you face-to-face and actually asks you, are you ready to empty the bucket for the Dallas Cowboys? And what he means by that, are you ready to give it your all? Because I'm fixing to write down a number on this pen and paper that you can't resist. And I want to make sure that I have your promise to me that you're going to give it your all no matter what. And I feel like that's what, you know, he did for Zeke.
I wonder, when he said that to you, do you say, yes, sir, I am. Are you ready to empty your wallet for DeMarcus Ware?
You know, the thing is, like, he did that for me. And got a big contract. And that was my second contract playing with them. And it was just great playing for an owner like Jerry Jones. And it was hard when he released me, but he was honest with me, saying that, hey, I can't pay you because it'll be a detriment to the team. But the thing is, a lot of owners won't do that, and they'll just release you. But he actually was honest with me, and that's why we're still, you know, he's an important part of my career, and it's great.
Yeah, and that's all you want, right, as a player. You want them to be straight up with you. That's it. You look me in the eye and tell me how it is, and I'm man enough, and I'll deal with this, and we'll just do business. That's how it is.
Exactly.
DeMarcus Ware joining us. So what kind of thoughts do you have when you watch this Cowboys defense?
The thing is, you look at a young, tenacious defense. At first, just starting with Sean Lee, who's been the cornerstone, and then all of a sudden you bring DeMarcus Lawrence on, you got Taco, and then you start looking at the linebacker core with Van Der Esch and Jalen Smith. And then you're like, okay, well, does it get even better than this? And you got a young cornerback that doesn't even have Byron Jones yet back, and they're balling out. So it's like the sky is the limit from a defensive standpoint, and they have depth in those areas. So they can get the job done, and they are, you know, I can see Marinelli really opening up that defense and doing things that he usually normally don't do is blitz, because those guys are so athletic now, and I really like seeing
DeMarcus Ware is joining us once again. I'm so glad you brought up Marinelli. He is one of my favorite coaches ever. Like, when I've had Jalen Smith on the program in the past, we've talked about Rod Marinelli and how much he loves playing for him. You just mentioned him. What do you remember about playing for Rod?
You know, one thing that I like about Rod is how aggressive his defense is. And he didn't blitz as much with us because we had an awesome front four, but he let us rush the passer. And one thing he always told me, think about pass rushing first and run second. So rush to the quarterback, and hopefully if they hand the ball off, you'll be there before they even get to the handing the ball off, and you'll make the play. And that's my mentality. Be as aggressive as you can and wreak havoc. And he's brought on a plethora of guys that can do that. And I think like this right here is going to – I feel like this right here is going to be their year as a defense to really step it up.
You know, I was going to say, so if this is their year defensively and they got Ezekiel Elliott's deal done, when you look at talent on both sides of the ball for the Cowboys, does it feel like a Super Bowl team to you?
It feels like a Super Bowl team to me when I start thinking about all the guys' names that are on the team, the guys that can actually contribute and carry them to the latter part of the season. And what I want to see is them start the season off right, because the way that their schedule is, they're starting a lot of NFC East games. Right? We can see that with the Giants. They start with Washington. Then after that, like a couple of games later, they got like Philly and, you know, Green Bay. If they can get a lot of these NFC teams done early, meaning like winning those games, they're going to be in a catbird seat saying that now in the latter part of the season, we can just close it out now. And that's what I want to see, them start off right at home against the Giants and get a win.
We're talking to DeMarcus Ware. All right, so if you go back to your time in Denver and that beating that you and Von Miller put on Tom Brady, that still remains one of the all-time great performances against a guy who doesn't take a lot of hits. Obviously, he gets it out so quickly. What do you remember about that game?
I just remember that game. Me and Von, we sat there and we said, hey, if we want to make the Super Bowl, we're going to have to step up our game. We're going to have to not get as many sacks, but we're going to have to hit the quarterback as many times as we can. And actually, we set a record that year where I think it was like 32 times we hit the quarterback, hit Tom Brady. We still almost lost the game. And that's what you have to do against a guy like Brady, because he doesn't stop. He's the best. He's a GOAT. But that's what we had to do. And that's what I feel like the Dallas Cowboy defensive line is going to have to do. They're going to have to wreak havoc. They're going to have to make big plays, because now they've signed, what, you know, DeMarcus Lawrence. And they have other guys that can contribute. And that's what's going to set them over the top, because if you let Dak get even 30 yards in, they're going to score, because that's where they're the most effective.
DeMarcus Ware joining us. So in terms of hitting the quarterback, in the Super Bowl that year, you and the defense really got after Cam Newton. When Andrew Luck announced his retirement a few weeks back, there were lots of fans questioning his toughness. But as one of the guys responsible for hitting a quarterback, what kind of toughness does it keep or take to keep taking those hits and keep getting right back up?
You know what the thing is, like, one thing no one can do is question Andrew Luck, toughness. He's one of the toughest quarterbacks to take down, but also he's one of the, it's weird. They talk about he's one of the nicest guys once you hit him. Yeah, I hit him a couple of times, and he's like, ah, great hit, bud. I'm like, what? I'm coming back.
Right.
To make sure you don't say that again. But, you know, you get to a point in your career to where, you know, either mentally you're going to be able to compete, but physically you can't. And if you can't do that, you don't want to now go out there and play, you know, half of what your capacity is and look bad. Or maybe you don't have that drive anymore. When those things happen, you hang up the cleats. A lot of people aren't going to accept it. And you move on, because at the end of the day, you don't want to have to sleep with your decision.
You know, I'm listening to you, DeMarcus. You sound great and you look great. And I say that because I'm looking at you on Instagram. There's a piece on you in Men's Health also. And anybody who follows your IG account can see the time you're putting in still on your workouts. You've been working out your entire life. So I would understand maybe if you want to take a step back or relax in retirement, but clearly you're still getting after it. Why is that important to you?
It's important to me because in my career, fitness was everything. Like, you know, just staying in shape and keeping my body right. And now I have an opportunity. It's almost like my passion that I started doing in football has now transcended into something else, as being like the ultimate coach, the ultimate trainer in the fitness realm. Because now not only can I affect the people like I did playing football inside of the stadium, I can affect the people outside of the stadium through fitness and being healthy and be their captain, right? That's the way I look at it. I know my locker room is not the locker room with the guys. My locker room is now the gym. So it's like, come on into the gym, and now I can be a captain in a lot more other people's lives to create some great change.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I also like the fact that we can still have Snickers. That is my favorite bar. You're working with Snickers.
Yes.
To honor the league's hungriest player from week to week, lay it out. What is the weekly honor for the hungriest player? How does this get decided?
So it actually, it's a two-part series where, you know, the hungriest player and fan, they actually get rewarded this chain. It's a $60,000 chain crafted by this guy named Ben Baller from L.A., right? But with this Baller chain, that's why I call it the Baller chain, because there's 42 carats of diamonds on it. They get this chain. I will be the first person to give this chain out. It's heavy, by the way, so that means you're going to have to perform in a way to where it's feasible, right? But once they get this chain, they get to give it to a different guy every single week. So the first guy gets it, give it to the next guy. And then the fans get to actually, the 12th man get to follow that whole chain process through hashtag Snickers chain, right? And it's almost like the new Flat Stanley. What is the story of this chain going around the league? And once this story ends, you know, at the end of the season, now that money that chain is worth, which is $60,000, that person gets to donate that money to a charity. So it's not just on the field stuff through performance, but it's off the field stuff through the charity work that they do, which makes it really great.
Great cause. I love that. He is a Super Bowl champ, a 9-time Pro Bowl selection. He appears courtesy of Snickers today. That is DeMarcus Ware. DeMarcus, I've always appreciated you in this relationship. So good to have you back, man. Thank you very much.
Hey, the Rome is burning, baby.
So the New York Mets have taken a justified beating around here for a few straight years. You know, the kind of beating that Jason Vargas threatened a beat reporter with back in June. The kind of beating that Mickey Cowell would be proud to reference if Billy Martin was the one giving it.
No, I mean, Billy Martin punched a reporter one time. You know, I mean, it's just part of this game, you know.
Punching a reporter is part of the game. Punching a guy for doing his job is part of the game. Easy, John McGraw. Easy, Connie Mack. It's an all-time bad take. Billy Martin once punched a reporter, man. That's part of the game. And notice how I never once wasted any airtime when this disaster squad was going 22-6 between the end of July and the middle of August to pull within a half game of the second wildcard spot. Now, it's not that I'm biased. It's not that I'm only looking to talk about the Mets when they're lighting themselves on fire and swan diving into pools of kerosene. I mean, that would be rooting. I do not root. I don't root for anything other than something to talk about. No, the reason I didn't talk about the Mets when they ran off 22 of 28 is because I'm not some cheese trap mouse. I'm not a rat. Oh, dude, there was a huge rat in my garage yesterday. Huge ass rat. So I know a rat when I see it. I know a rat family when I see that. You know how I know? I made it up. Anyway, I'm not a cheese trap mouse. I've been around here long enough to know when there is a hammer above a block of cheddar.
It's a trap.
Right? Peaking in August is never ideal, especially when you're the Mets and there is still over a month to throw that rig in reverse, drop a cinder block on the gas pedal, and back right back into that same grave that you spent 28 games allegedly digging out of. Which is exactly what the Mets did when they lost 6 straight to the Braves and the Cubs last week to fall 5 games back of that second wildcard spot. I mean, like, how stupid would I have been? No surprise, though, because if something is too good to be true, if it seems too good to be true, it typically is. And the Mets, playing like they were the best team in baseball, was way too good to be true or real. So they crashed right back to earth like I knew they would. The thing that I didn't know is that they could somehow crash back down to earth and smash right through the crust, obliterate the mantle, decimate the molten outer core, and finally come to rest in a million little pieces somewhere buried deep inside the center of the planet. Psych!
Psych.
Of course I knew they would do that. Why do you think I didn't mention them? And they did do that last night against the Nationals in the district when they took a 6-run lead into the bottom of the ninth. They needed to get 3 outs before the other guys scored 6 runs. Do that, and then you take a game against the wildcard leaders. Now, for context, the Mets came into last night's game. Even the Mets now. The Mets. They were lifetime, all-time, 806-0. 806-0. Like, the only thing in life that's undefeated is sex, father time, and the Mets with a 6-run lead in the ninth. Those 3 things. They were 806-0 all time when they led by 6 or more runs in the ninth. 57 years of Mets baseball. They had never once blown a 6-run ninth inning lead. So here's how the bottom of the ninth went. Try your best to follow along. Paul Sewald came on to pitch for New York. First battery faces Victor Robles. He reaches on infield single. Nothing hurt. Doesn't matter. No big deal. Still a 6-run lead. Howie Kendrick steps into the box. He flies to right. So, 1 on, 1 out in the bottom of the ninth. Now they need 2 outs before the other guy gets 7 runs. Again, they're up 10-4. Fangraphs had their win probability after that Kendrick pop-up at 99.8%. Trey Turner, next up. He doubles. He scores Robles. No worries. That's why you score 10 runs, so you can protect a lead. Right now, they're still up 5. They still need to get just 2 outs to get the hell off the field and pick up a game. As Drubal Cabrera singles, that gives the Nats runners at the corners. Anthony Rendon follows that with a base knock. That scores Turner. That moves Cabrera over to second. Now it's 10-6. 2 on, 1 out. Mickey Callaway getting a little nervous. He's seen enough. He brings in Luis Avilon. He immediately gives up a station-to-station single to Juan Soto. Hit the bricks, Avilon. It's Edwin Diaz time. Y'all remember Edwin Diaz, right? Baseball's most dominant closer last year, but an arsonist for the Mets this year. That Edwin Diaz. Whatever. He will clean up this annoying little mess. All he's got to do is get a couple of outs, protect a 4-run lead, do his job, get the hell out of here. No problem, right? Why don't we find out? Here's Ryan Zimmerman against Diaz with the bases juiced.
10-6 now. Zimmerman, right center, well hit, and it's up against the scoreboard. 2 runs will score. Held at third is Soto, and it's 10-8.
Are you kidding me?
Uh-oh! 10-8 Mets, 2 men on. Still just 1 out. Already 4 across. And Kurt Suzuki at the dish. Can the Mets get out of this? In the immortal words of Ja Rule, I guess not.
I guess not.
3-2 to Suzuki. Swung on. And deep to left field. Way back. Going. Going. It's gone. Goodbye. Game over. Kurt Suzuki has done it again. And if you walked out of this ballpark when the Mets scored 5 runs in the top of the ninth inning, you blew it.
Actually, the Mets blew it. Hard. For the first time in franchise history, they choked away a 6-run lead in the ninth. Not only have the Mets never done that, but the Nats Expos franchise had never come back from being down that many runs in the ninth inning. So if I told you that an organization just got their biggest comeback win ever, would it come as any surprise to anybody that that franchise, that organization came back on the Mets? Man, I could sit here all day long and talk about how improbable that loss was for the Mets, because it was. Or how freaking absolutely atrocious their bullpen is, because it is. Or that they effectively ended their shot at all, any shot they had at the postseason last night, because they did. Or that this season has been a 6-month joke with a new punchline every single month, because it has been. But you know that already. Why would I waste my time, and why would I waste your time? Instead, there are just 3 words that anybody needs to know when we're talking about this team. Mets gonna Met. Mets gonna Met because they always do.
You blew it!
Brian Harsin is my guest. Brian, nice to have you back on. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. Yeah, everything's going well. Just excited for this week.
Good. Can't wait to talk to you about this week, but let me get you a look back, if you don't mind, first. You've got Marshall Bryant on Friday, but if we were to go back to last week, you were getting ready to play Florida State in Jacksonville, but due to weather, that game was moved to Tallahassee. The game time moved from a night game to noon. You're already flying all the way across the country. There's one logistical change after another, including your Friday practice being delayed by lightning. I mean, what was the mood like around the program throughout the entire process?
Yeah, really just adapt and adjust. You know, we were going to have some adversity. We knew that just playing Florida State, and then things changed. We knew about the weather, and we knew there might be some adjustments there. We didn't know there'd be as many as we actually had. So our players really thrived on the adversity. I thought they handled it well. I thought it became really the theme of our entire trip was, hey, one thing after another, they got excited about it, and it showed up on game day. It was, you know, adversity in the first half. In the second half, it was really that conversation. Hey, we've gone through so much to get here. Let's go find a way and put ourselves in a position to have success in the second half. And that's exactly what they did. And the reason why, they just kept answering the bell throughout this entire trip. Every time something changed, nobody flinched. And I thought in the second half, we actually showed that when we went out there and played. So I feel like our guys deserved to win because of the things they went through to get there, and they ended up getting it done on that Saturday, and it was a great opportunity for our guys to just persevere and be 1-0 for the season and to do it the way they did it.
Brian Harsin joining us. I want to be very clear about this for those who may have missed it. Florida State jumped out to a 21-6 lead in the first quarter, 31-13, with just over 4 minutes left in the first half. It would have been very easy for your guys just to maybe give in and say this was not our day, just not our time, but that's not what happened. They battle all the way back, and you point out how proud you were. Let me ask you this. In the buildup to the game, the players saw a hype video. There was a 7-minute highlight package from the 2010 win over Virginia Tech. Curtis Weaver said, quote, "Just seeing what our tradition has done in the past, what they've done, it made us build that confidence and keep that going," end quote. So, Brian, my question is, I know you're not somebody looking to talk about previous seasons, but how important was it to remind your guys this is a program that has a tradition of taking down big-time opponents?
Well, that was really the message. And the message also was, in 2014, Florida State won a national championship, and we have an opportunity to go in there and play a program like that and to take our shot. And really showing that video of Virginia Tech, it just reminded me a lot of that game. ACC, kind of a neutral site, NFL stadium. So there was a lot of similarities I felt like that the players could take away from it. And we watched that video. We watched our guys get out to a faster start and then Virginia Tech come back. And then at the end of the game, come through and find a way to win. And it was kind of the reversal of that in the first half for us against Florida State, but more of it was just the mentality of the opportunity that's in front of you, the preparation that you should have when you have opportunities like this. And so go out there and do the work. And things are not going to go our way. We're going to face adversity. We're going to have challenges. They're not going to overlook us. So just understand what you're getting into. And I felt like the players took a lot away from that. And then, you know, ultimately, if Curtis or guys on their team are talking about it, then, you know, that's something that you hope clicks, and it did in this last game.
Boise State head football coach Brian Harsin joining us after that win over Florida State. You know, there's a lot of other guys I could single out, but Hank Bachmeier, your true freshman and quarterback, was starting his first game on the road at Florida State. Took a lot of hits, but kept on rolling. Ends up with more than 400 yards passing. It was a performance that made the country take notice. But knowing what you know about him, were you surprised, or is that pretty much what you expected from him?
Well, we've seen him in practice. You know, you never know. He never got hit one time since last spring, so I had no idea, you know, how he would handle himself going out there and taking some hits. Yeah, he showed tremendous toughness. That was something that really stood out to me that we talk a lot about in that room. And, you know, I thought that was on display against Florida State. Now, I didn't expect the 400 yards and really didn't even know that. You know, we went in there with the idea that we're going to run the football and try to take care of our quarterback. And we ended up with a lot more plays in that game than we probably expected. But he did a tremendous job of, you know, just coming back after, you know, getting hit or after a sack or after a turnover. You know, he was able to just put that last play away and just onto that next play, and that mentality and that toughness I thought was a big reason in that second half why we just kept kind of plugging away and getting staying close enough until we could finally get in the fourth quarter just ahead because of how he played. And so that's good. You know, that was his first game. He's a true freshman, but he certainly didn't act like that in this game. And he showed a lot of heart, a lot of toughness. And so hopefully that continues as we continue to play this season.
Brian Harsin joining us. The season continues against Marshall on Friday. You know, it was not just the offense that turned things around. The defense held Florida State to 44 yards on its last nine drives. How would you describe the identity, the mentality of the defense?
I thought they did a great job in the second half. Coach Schmetting, our defensive coordinator, he got a chance to see his players for the first time live. And so, you know, just the adjustments that they made in the second half and really just settling down and playing the way we're capable of playing on defense, tackling better, getting around the football, taking advantage of opportunities when the ball is on the ground or in the air. And those are things that we've seen from our defense. We do have a veteran group. I know what they're capable of playing like, and they started to really show that in the second half when they settled down and we made a few adjustments. And you know, the turnovers, the momentum, the offense that Florida State has, they're explosive. They got really good players. They got a really good system. And so for how we played in the second half, I thought they did an outstanding job. And that that created that momentum, that created that hope, that gave our offense an opportunity to be in better field position so we could score points. And just a great group effort by both sides, special teams included. Eric Sachs, you know, a transfer kicker for us. He really kept us in the game and gave us a lot of hope just by hitting those field goals one after another. And it was just a group effort by everybody, and certainly the defense shined in that second half.
You know, then before you go, you were talking about prepare for the opportunity, prepare for a great opportunity like this. You go back to July, you had a day called Deck Day. For those who do not know, what is Deck Day, and what do you want your guys to take away from it?
Yeah, well, Deck Day, well, that goes back a lot of years, Jim, and a lot of us have been a part of that. It's really, you know, getting the upper decks here of this stadium and the way our stadium is built and pitched. You know, you run those bleachers, and it's no easy task. And it's something that's part of, you know, as we finish up summer, that blue-collar work, that blue-collar identity that we have. And getting up there, and this year the guys run 20 of them, and that's really the build-up all the way through the summer. And once we're done with that, we break into fall camp. And so it's just the work necessary to truly go out there and be successful. You know, that's one of the things I hope our guys, when they come to Boise State, they understand that you've got to do the work. And there's no easy road. There's no free lunches. It takes what it takes. And to me, that's part of what Deck Day is. It's a grind. It's hard. It's meant to be. It's never going to be easy. Even if you've gone through it 4 or 5 years, every time you have to go through it, it's difficult. But that's a season. And that just reminds you and kind of humbles you to, as you go into this year, no matter the experience you have, hey, it's one game at a time and focus on that, and every opponent matters, and you got to put in the preparation to go out there and get the job done.
You know, and then it's not a good team or a good couple of years, it's a great program. And the guys that you're asking to do this, the guys who before them have also done that. So, in other words, you invite guys back, players, former players, back for Deck Day. How many guys came back, and then what's it mean to have a program where former players continue to come back and support the current players?
Well, I think that's part of our family atmosphere, and we talk about once a Bronco, always a Bronco. We had about 20 guys come back, and they've got coffee and donuts, and the other guys are up there running, and every single one of them, you know, at the beginning of it, it's always interesting because they're just sitting back and watching, and then probably about deck 11, 12, 13, when the guys start to really fatigue, you could feel those former players start to cheer these guys on because it just takes them back to when they did it. And it's that, you know, again, just those guys helping the younger players out and that brotherhood, you know, around this culture and this program of, hey, you can do it. We want to see you do it. We're right here with you. And I think the current players appreciate that because they know, hey, there's life after football and being a part of this team matters. And they're going to have their opportunity someday to come back and give back to the players that are going to be out there doing the work.
It's a great program with a great legacy, a great tradition, and they add to that with that come-from-behind win over Florida State. You've got Boise State hosting Marshall Friday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, and their head football coach is Brian Harsin, already 6 seasons in. Brian, great to visit with you on this show, as always. Thanks so much, and great talking to you.
Hey, appreciate you, and go Broncos.
Let's go to Wichita. Drizzle in Wichita. Drizzle, what's going on?
Yo, what's happening with you, Romy?
What's up? What's up? What's up?
First time caller. You smell me, man?
I do, man.
Check game while the Zeke Watch haters is out here in full force running their mouth. They don't understand that while they in their cubicles flicking their boogers after picking them, Zeke about to over 2K and a splash waterfall all the way to the Super Bowl. It's Cowboys Nation all day, every day. They just paid their man. If you want to beat a man, you got to beat the man. Shout out to Ric Flair. He already beat the man. Now they about to run all their way to Super Bowl number what? Forget all that, man. The NFC East is ours. The NFC is ours. Z going for 2K in the highway. It ain't nothing but to get the cooking, man. Out, Rome.
Dude, where you been? Who the hell are you, Drizzle, and where the hell have you been? My man, that was amazing. Let's go to Crescent City first. Trapper in Crescent City. Trapper, what's going on?
Yeah, this is old Trapper. I got to tell you, Jim, back in the 80s, I used to chew their jerky while working the trawler decks 200 miles out in the Atlantic Fleet. A very good product. Got to talk about David from Wisconsin yesterday, who was bragging about his 23 years in the state prison. A couple things, David. Congratulations on turning your life around after your time in the joint. And like you, I can empathize with the therapeutic value of Jim Rome in the jungle. I recall, Jimmy, 16, 17 years ago when I crashed on dope, got my neck broken in a Santa Ana shooting gallery alley, and after surgery, voluntarily going into the Salvation Army for 6 months to get my life back. I listen to you, Jim, in the warehouse every day as we worked the loading docks that paid for my program. I even, as you remember, snuck out one day to do the smack off. Back to you, Dave. Nice job pimping your ride, your crib, your gig. Sorry, pal, but that's all doing what you're supposed to do in life, like most of the people within the sound of my voice. I've been a defense attorney, a prosecutor, a DA, and a recovering drug addict. David, I sent enough people to Pelican Bay, Susanville, Chowchilla, San Quentin, a few more, enough to know the score. At 16, as a juvie, probably tried as an adult, you committed a crime or crimes that bought you two dimes and three in state prison? And you brag on that, my brother? 23 years stateside, Dave, tells me you committed some nasty felony or felonies, maybe even a busted down homicide. Means you hurt some innocent people, David. Bad. Real bad. So, Dave, you want to come into our jungle and trot out your bona fides? First, you tell me what restitution you made to those victims. What amends did you make to them? And, Dave, you tell me that, then you come in here and throw some sprinkles on that icing you laid on us. I guess, Jimmy, for last for old Trapper, moms and dads, you feed that to your kids for breakfast, and just maybe they grow up someday to be a made guy. Tramps like us, babe. Thanks for the dime. I'm out.
Wow. Trapper.
Good night now!